Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for Thursday, May 9th. All materials heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Teresa Whitaker and Lisa Horsch. Here's our first story. Eminent domain targeted. Lawmakers, activists vow to revisit restrictions next year, by Caleb McCullough, out of Des Moines. For the third year in a row, Iowa House lawmakers passed a bill to restrict eminent domain use for carbon capture pipelines during the 2024 session. But the legislation, proposing more court oversight of the projects, failed to advance in the Senate. The bill was passed as activists opposing the controversial projects made frequent trips to the Capitol this year, pushing lawmakers to prevent the involuntary taking of land with compensation for their construction. Those activists and the bill's supporters in the legislature say they expect to keep advocating to pass regulations next year. Two companies, Summit Carbon Solutions and Wolf Carbon Solutions US, have proposed projects that will capture CO2 emitted in ethanol production and send it underground for storage, benefiting from lucrative federal tax credits and low carbon fuel markets. A third company, Navigator CO2 Ventures, canceled its planned pipeline last year after facing regulatory hurdles. A portion of landowners along the Summit Pipeline's route, opposed to the use of eminent domain, have pushed to shut down the project's construction and pressured lawmakers to restrict or outright ban the projects. Wolf Carbon Solutions has said it does not plan to use eminent domain for its much smaller pipeline. The environmental group, the Sierra Club, has also pushed to stop the projects, viewing them as an ineffective solution to climate change that prop up fossil fuels. According to a March Des Moines Register MediaCom Iowa poll, 78% of Iowans oppose the use of eminent domain to construct CO2 pipelines. Iowa has existing laws that govern the permitting of carbon dioxide pipelines and allow the use of eminent domain for their construction under certain circumstances. Iowa Utilities Board has the final say in approving or denying projects. Opponents of the pipelines argue those laws should be changed because the pipelines are for-profit projects and not public utilities. Supporters of the pipelines, including ethanol and corn growers groups, say the projects are necessary to respond to growing demand for low-carbon fuels and to allow Iowa ethanol to be used in sustainable aviation fuel. House lawmakers passed a bill this year that would allow a landowner or a company involved in a carbon dioxide capture pipeline proceeding to petition a court to review whether eminent domain is warranted for the project. The bill would also have allowed a person or group to challenge the IUB's approval or denial. I thought I had the right page. One moment. Or denial of a pipeline permit without issuing a bond. That bill, House File 2664, passed with overwhelming bipartisan support in the House, 86-7. While it passed out of a subcommittee in the Senate, it was never taken up for consideration in the Ways and Means Committee. Republicans hold majorities in both chambers. Representative Charlie Thompson, a Republican from Charles City, who managed the bill, said the Senate's inability to pass the bill was a black mark on the chamber. He said landowners who have held out from signing easements with Summit have already suffered harm as they've had to wait years to determine whether their land will be taken. "We as a state need to step up and make this wrong right," Thompson said. "I think it would benefit everybody, including the pipeline folks, to get a rapid determination of whether this is a legal proposal." All but seven House Republicans voted for the proposal, and all Democrats supported it. In the Senate, the bill passed out of a Ways and Means subcommittee, but it was never taken up for a vote in the full committee. Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitaker, a Republican from Grimes, has said Senate Republicans who hold 34 of the chamber's 50 seats have varying opinions on the projects and whether eminent domain restrictions should be passed, which has contributed to the chamber not voting on any of the House's proposals. "There are people in our caucus all over the board," he said in an interview before the session began. "Some very supportive of the pipeline, some that aren't as supportive of the pipeline. So right now, we're kind of a split caucus." The pipelines are supported by Iowa's ethanol industry and corn growers. Ethanol industry leaders have said they are necessary for biofuels' continued success as more states and countries demand low-carbon fuels. Tax credits for the sequestration of carbon dioxide have also been expanded under the last two presidential administrations. Senator Jason Schultz, a Republican of Schleswig, who ran the Senate subcommittee and supported the bill, said some senators support the projects because of that market potential. We have folks who are representing the position of renewable fuels and Iowa corn growers that this is absolutely important, Schultz said. I just don't think economic considerations trump property rights, especially when one of those considerations is something as silly as the Green New Deal and environmental factors like that. House Minority Leader Jennifer Confrist, a Democrat of Windsor Heights, said in an appearance on Iowa Press on Iowa PBS last week that Democrats had been talking with voters in rural Iowa about eminent domain. She said the focus on CO2 pipelines has made it difficult to have a broader conversation about the right use of eminent domain. They are sick and tired of corporations coming in and using eminent domain to take their land, and I think what we're seeing right now is sort of an uprising of a long-brewing frustration with corporate interests taking over farmland in this state, Confrist said. Kim Junker, a Butler County resident who owns land along the proposed summit route, has been pushing lawmakers to restrict the projects for the last 3 years. She said she believes a bill would pass if it was taken up for a vote in the Senate, but that there are a few lawmakers who have blocked their passage so far. Junker said she liked the proposal this year to allow a court review of the process, especially the piece that eliminated a bond requirement for challenging an IUB decision. This year's elections could make a difference in how much support pipeline restrictions have, Junker said. Many of the activists opposing the pipelines are Republicans, and the issue has become a lightning rod in some GOP primary races. Republican Doug Campbell, who is challenging Senate Commerce Committee Chair Waylon Brown in the Mason City area, has made the pipeline issue a central focus of his campaign. The Iowa Utilities Board is weighing Summit Carbon Solutions' permit application. While there is no set date for a decision, the board could decide before the next legislative session begins. Still, Republican supporters of the legislation say they plan to raise the issue again next year and are hoping they can make more progress. One proposal that was initially included in this year's bill would have allowed around 20% of the members of either the House or the Senate to pause an eminent domain proceeding before the IUB. Thompson said that proposal may come up again, and he said there were other potential policies the House will consider that he declined to share. We're going to keep at it next year, and we have some other things we're going to be doing, he said. I refuse to accept that where such a supermajority of Iowans are against something, that their representative government is not even going to look at it in the form of the Senate.
We do have a nice picture on the front page that I would like to share with you. It's titled Celebrating New Citizens, and it shows a young man in a suit holding out a certificate above his head to the crowd, and the people behind him all have big smiles on their faces. And the caption says, Kalapwi Kalendi, an immigrant from the Democratic Republic of Congo, smiles as he receives his naturalization certificate at the Central District of Illinois' Naturalization Ceremony on Wednesday, May 8th at the Rock Island Library in Watts Midtown Branch. 31 new citizens from 12 countries were naturalized among friends and family. Teen accused in killing charged as an adult. This is written by Anthony Watt. A teen accused of the killing of Danny Taylor in 2023 now faces charges as an adult. Danny Taylor, age 17, was shot on April 14, 2023 at his home in rural Milan, authorities have said. Investigators think his assailants intended a robbery. Three people have been charged in relation to the killing, the records state. They are John L. Smith III, age 16, address unavailable, Napoleon Jackson, 17, from Rock Island, and Tatonia Taylor, 20, from Milan. Initially, the Rock Island County State Attorney's Office charged Smith as a juvenile with first-degree murder and home invasion, court records state. On Tuesday, prosecutors filed two adult charges of first-degree murder and one adult count of home invasion against Smith. Underlying one of the murder charges are allegations that Smith, or one for whom he was accountable, killed Taylor with a gun during the commission of a home invasion, court records state. The other murder charge states that Smith, or a person for whom he was accountable, shot Taylor and knew that doing so created a strong probability of death or great bodily harm, court records state. The home invasion charge alleges Smith, or someone for whom he was responsible, entered Taylor's residence while carrying a firearm and knowing people were likely to be present, court records state. Smith had no legal justification for doing so, and once inside, they used force or the threat of force on the occupants. Documents state the courts have set an arraignment and detention hearing for Smith on Thursday. As of Wednesday, he was in custody at the Mary Davis Juvenile Detention Facility in Galesburg. Prosecutors have already petitioned to deny Smith retrial release, records show. That petition provides further details of what investigators think happened that morning at the Taylor residence. The morning that Danny Taylor died, his father, David, heard loud noises downstairs from the area of his son's room, the petition states. When he investigated, he found two masked youths confronting Danny Taylor. Both youths had handguns. Father and son began fighting with the two, the petition states. Investigators think David Taylor fought Smith while Danny Taylor fought Jackson. David Taylor was starting to overpower Smith when he heard a gunshot, then his son saying he had been shot, the petition says. Jackson then turned the gun on David Taylor, but shot Smith instead, authorities allege in court documents. One of the two then struck David Taylor with a pistol. Records did not specify whether Jackson or Smith was suspected of doing this. Jackson tried to shoot David Taylor again, but his gun jammed, states records state. Jackson and Smith then ran to a nearby vehicle in which Tatonia Taylor and another person waited. They then drove Smith to an area hospital. Smith, shot in the chest, eventually required treatment in Peoria. The petition also details evidence that authorities allege shows Smith's participation in the crime. The basement door of the Taylor residence had been kicked open. There was a mark from a shoe that appeared similar to the shoes connected to Smith. Tatonia Taylor and the other person also told police that Smith kicked in the door. Investigators recovered two suspect handguns at the Taylor residence, a .40 caliber and a 9mm, the petition states. The .40 caliber found near the house had Smith's fingerprints on it. Authorities think Jackson used the 9mm, records state. Police also found a shoe in the vehicle, which was used to drive Smith to the hospital. The shoe then had Smith's blood on it. While hospitalized in Peoria, Smith also remained in contact with Jackson and made statements linking both of them to the killing, court records state. Tatonia Taylor is not related to Danny Taylor, records state. She has been charged with home invasion in relation to the killing. Authorities allege she assisted in the home invasion by directing Jackson and Smith to Danny Taylor's home on April 14th and giving them information about how to access the residence, court records state. Tatonia Taylor remains in custody, according to state records. Her next hearing is set for May 24th. Jackson faces two charges of first-degree murder and one count each of home invasion and aggravated battery, records state. The battery charge relates to the allegation that Jackson shot Smith during the melee. Jackson also has also been held at Mary Davis, record state, and his next hearing has also been set for May 24th.
Teens killed in Moline fondly remembered. It's by Tom Lowy. They were known to many throughout their Moline community as Mickey and Gio. They shared a love of nice cars and nice clothes. They shared a sense of humor and a willingness to meet others with a smile. Zachary Meinke was 19 years old and Giovanni Flores was 17, and their lives ended early Sunday morning in the basement of a home in the 1800 block of 31st Street in Moline. According to friends of both teens, there was an after-prom party at the house. Flores was a junior at Moline High School, and Meinke graduated from the school in 2023. They were there to celebrate together, a mutual friend said Tuesday. Moline police officers were first called to the home on 31st Street at 2:30 a.m. Sunday because of a noise complaint. The responding officers said a number of people left the party before they arrived and the noise had subsided. 2 hours later, police officers were again called to the home to investigate a report of an unknown problem, according to a news release from the Moline Police Department. Officers found Flores and Meinke dead in the basement. Both teens had been shot. The families and friends of both young men offered their memories. Flores's obituary noted he worked at Johnny's Italian Steakhouse, where his charm and quick wit made him a favorite among his co-workers. His passions were as vibrant as his personality. He had an unparalleled love for fast cars, a commitment to fitness, and an eye for fashion, ensuring his shoes and attire were always impeccable. Meineke had much in common with his friend. His obituary said he was known for his vibrant personality and infectious smile. A lover of fast cars, playful corgis, competitive dart games, and engaging movies, Zach lived his life with a joy and enthusiasm that magnetically drew people to him. His spirit was characterized by a delightful goofiness, and he was invariably the life of any gathering. Meineke was involved with BMX racing from an early age. Hunter Minerisk said it was one of the bonds they shared after meeting in the first grade. Growing up with Zachary, there was never a dull moment. Absolutely beautiful soul and truly the sweetest out of all of us boys, Minerisk said in an email. Every day we were together, whether it was riding bikes and running the streets everywhere, and I mean everywhere. We put more miles on the bikes than most people do on their cars. We loved skating, BMX, and anything racing. His laugh and smile was infectious. He was deeply loved and will be missed more than anyone could imagine. Flores's obituary also mentioned his ability to bring laughter. Gio had the unique ability to light up any room he entered and leave a lasting impression with his jovial spirit, it read. His big heart and deep love for his family were evident to all who knew him. Gio always put his family and friends first, cherishing every moment spent with them. Meineke's obituary echoed the words written for Flores. Renowned for his big heart and warm hugs, Zach's greatest joy was the time spent surrounded by his beloved family and friends. He was a beacon of kindness and genuine affection, the obituary said. Logan Van Watermeulen knew Meineke from an early age and in perhaps a different way. He said he knew him as Zach, not Mickey. He said he knew a Zach who worked really hard to graduate from high school. To me, he was just a funny, lonely kid who only wanted friends, Van Watermeulen wrote. Yes, he wasn't an angel, but he was a good, kind-hearted person and would always help anyone in need. Most of the time, you didn't even have to ask. He'd just notice you were down and try to bring your mood up or to try any way he could. I've known him and his sister since he was in sixth grade, and his main goal was always to be able to take care of his mother and sisters and give them a stress-free life. It was all he ever talked about, being able to someday move them out of state and get away from the bad habits and people that unfortunately is the Quad Cities. Van Watermeulen also remembered Flores. I didn't know Gio well, but he was around when I was sometimes, and I liked him. He was a good person as well. Both are a loss to our community and future, he said.
Moline finalizes ADU ordinance, JCPenney building project approved. This is written by Joshua Shimkus. After five planning commission meetings in 2024, input from a wide variety of residents and multiple discussions among elected officials and city staff, on Tuesday, the Moline City Council approved an ordinance regulating accessory dwelling units, ADUs, within the city. Included in the ordinance are a host of restrictions. Only one ADU is allowed per lot, and lots must be at least 6,500 square feet to have an exterior ADU. ADUs may not be used as vacation rental units, units that are rented for less than 30 days. The owner of the property must live either in the principal structure or the ADU. They cannot live off-site. A stipulation was also added that if a garage is converted to an ADU, the required parking for the building must be replaced. But no other additional parking requirements for ADUs were included in the approved ordinance. Parking concerns have been a sticking point for some citizens who oppose allowing ADUs. In previous conversations with the Dispatch, Argus, Quad City Times, Anna Castro, alderman, of the 7th Ward, said residents of her ward had brought concerns to her about the proposed ordinances. Several residents in the 7th Ward, she said, oppose the ordinance. I serve my ward by representing them. Alderman Debbie Murphy, of the 1st Ward, said that many of the residents in her ward had concerns about parking and the lack of space already available in the 1st Ward. Both Murphy and Castro voted against the ordinance at Tuesday meeting. They had also voted against it at an earlier reading. Chris Mathias, the Community and Economic Development Director for Moline, said that he didn't expect parking to be a big issue. He said, I don't share those concerns. I don't think ADUs will really have the impact that people are worried about. Davenport, Bettendorf, and Rock Island have their own regulations managing ADUs, with Rock Island's adopted in 2020. In a separate vote on Tuesday, Moline City Council approved the final incentives agreement to turn the former Riverstone Group headquarters building on Fifth Avenue into 32 new apartments, also known as the JCPenney building. The completed project will have a daycare center on a portion of the ground floor operated by Western Illinois University, according to a city press release. The council approved the economic incentive agreement with Renew Moline and Bush Construction, which owns the building. City Administrator Bob Vita said the $6.8 million project is expected to start later in 2024, with anticipated completion in late 2025. This project will bring much-needed housing to our downtown and represents what is possible when local businesses and local government get together to invest in our shared community.
And also here on the local main page here, we have an article, Eaglets Named After Caitlin Clark. And there's a wonderful picture of one of the parents and two of the young, Caitlin and Clark, shown with their parent on the Arconic Eagle Cam. If anybody's watching that. This article is by Thomas Geyer. Iowa's women's basketball star Caitlin Clark now has two namesakes that will be flying around the Quad Cities. The eaglets born to liberty and justice at the Arconic Nest this year now have names Caitlin and Clark. John Ritchie's communications and public affairs manager at Arconic Davenport Works said Tuesday the names Caitlin and Clark received 36% of the votes, while Pride and Joy received 28% of the votes. Liberty and Justice, a pair of bald eagles, have been at the nest for about 15 years. They made their home at Arconic's manufacturing plant in Riverdale in 2009. Bald eagles mate for life. According to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, bald eagles live 15 to 25 years in the wild. Caitlin and Clark are the 21st and 22nd eaglets for Liberty and Justice. According to the Audubon Center for Birds of Prey, eaglets are ready to fly at 10 to 12 weeks. Most eaglets fledge around 12 weeks. The eaglets hatched a few days apart during the first week of April.
Police residency requirements are expanded. This is written by Joshua Shimkus. Under an update to city ordinances, East Moline police officers will be able to live further from the city center. On Monday evening, East Moline City Council passed an ordinance extending the residency requirements for police officers to within 25 miles of City Hall. Prior to passage of this ordinance, they were limited to living within 19 and a half miles of City Hall. Officers are required to live within the residency requirement by the end of their 18-month probationary period. The residency requirement change was agreed to during negotiations for the updated Fraternal Order of Police contract with the city, which began in 2024, Police Chief Jeff Ramsey said. Ramsey said that there have been instances in the past where potential applicants didn't apply due to the residency requirements, and he hopes the change will help with recruitment and widen the pool of applicants for positions. Not all police departments have residency requirements. Even with the increase, East Moline has a smaller requirement than other local communities. According to a job posting in Moline, police officers must live within 40 miles of the city's emergency center within 2 years of being hired. In Rock Island, police must be able to commute from their residence to the police department within 60 minutes.
Two killed in separate crashes. This is by Anthony Watt. Two crashes less than an hour apart killed two people on Interstate 88 in East Moline on Wednesday. The first crash happened just after 8 a.m. in the westbound lanes just east of Exit 2, according to a news release from the East Moline Police Department. A box truck struck the rear of a semi-trailer that was entering the roadway from the shoulder. Authorities sent the driver of the box truck to Genesis Health Systems Illini campus in Silvis, where later he was pronounced dead, the release states. The semi-trailer's driver was not hurt, the department said. Police cited the driver of the semi-trailer for violating the minimum speed regulation. The second crash happened just before 9 a.m., just east of where the first crash occurred, the department said. Another semi-trailer began slowing down because of the crash scene and was hit by a sedan. The driver of the sedan was also sent to the Genesis Health Systems Illini campus, and she was later pronounced dead. The two occupants of the semi-trailer were not hurt. No citations have been issued for the second crash, the department said. Authorities were not yet releasing the names of the two people killed. Both crashes remained under investigation Wednesday afternoon, the department said. Authorities ask anyone with information to contact the East Moline Police at 309-792-1547. They can also contact Crime Stoppers at 309-762-9500 or via the P3 Tips app.
Rock Island Milan hosts planning meetings. Written by Olivia Allen. The Rock Island Milan School District is hosting a series of meetings this month to gather community input on facilities planning. According to the school district's website, Rock Island Milan leaders are developing a building infrastructure and facilities maintenance plan to guide the long and short-term future of district facilities. At these meetings, the district will also distribute a survey to gauge specific improvements for each building. Each meeting will run from 6 to 7 p.m., scheduled as follows. Thursday, May 9th at Rock Island High School for the high school, Thursday Thurgood Marshall Learning Center and Horace Mann Early Learning Center families. On Thursday, May 30th at Washington Junior High School in Rock Island, for Washington, Rock Island Center for Math and Science, Rock Island Academy and Longfellow, Eugene Field and Dinkman Elementary School families. Rock Island Milan kicked these meetings off at Edison Junior High on Wednesday for Edison, Thomas Jefferson and Ridgewood, Francis Willard and Ern Hansen Elementary School families. For those who can't make these dates in person, the district will hold virtual options via Google Meet at 8 a.m. and noon on Tuesday, May 14th and Tuesday, May 21st.
Quad City Schools graduation ceremonies. As local students prepare for graduation, here's a list of upcoming commencement ceremonies for Quad City's metro schools. In higher education, Scott Community College, its commencement ceremony will be at 6 p.m. on Friday, May 10th at Vibrant Arena at the Mark. Western Illinois University Quad Cities, 1 p.m. on Sunday, May 12th at Vibrant Arena. Blackhawk College, 7 p.m. on Thursday, May 16th at the Vibrant Arena. St. Ambrose University, on Saturday, May 18th, commencement for the 2023 Master's Program graduates at 9 a.m., followed by its 2024 undergraduate ceremony at 1 p.m. at Vibrant Arena. Augustana College, 2 p.m. on Saturday, May 25th at Vibrant Arena. Palmer College of Chiropractic, 11 a.m. on Friday, June 14th in Vicki and Palmer Hall. And in high school graduations, we have the Quad Cities Christian School commencement at 10:30 a.m. on Saturday, May 25th at the junior-senior high school campus. North Scott High School is at noon Sunday, May 26th at Vibrant Arena. Pleasant Valley High School, 3:30 p.m. Sunday, May 26th at Vibrant Arena. Bettendorf High School, 1 p.m. Sunday, May 26th at the football field in Bettendorf, weather permitting. Rivermont Collegiate at 1 p.m. Sunday, May 26th on campus in Bettendorf. Alleman High School, 1 p.m. Sunday, May 26th at Augustana College's Centennial Hall in Rock Island. Assumption High School, 5:30 p.m. Sunday, May 26th in the school's gymnasium in Davenport, preceded by a baccalaureate mass at 3 p.m. Mid-City High School, 7 p.m. on Wednesday, May 29th at the Central Performing Arts Center in Davenport. Rock Island High School, 10 a.m. Saturday, June 1st at Vibrant Arena. United Township High School, 2:30 p.m. Saturday, June 1st at Vibrant Arena. Moline High School, 7:30 p.m. Saturday, June 1st at Vibrant Arena. Davenport Central High School, 10 a.m. Sunday, June 2nd at Vibrant Arena. Davenport North High School, 1:30 p.m. Sunday, June 2nd at Vibrant Arena. And Davenport West High School at 5 p.m. Sunday, June 2nd at Vibrant Arena. You are listening to the Quad City Times on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now we'll turn to today's obituaries.
We have two obituaries today. The first one's from Davenport, Marilyn R. Hagman. Marilyn R. Hagman, age 101, of Davenport, passed away peacefully Monday, April 29th, at her daughter's home. Cremation will take place at Trimble Crematory in Moline under the direction of Cremation Society of the Quad Cities. Graveside services will take place at a later date at Rock Island National Cemetery. Memorials may be made to Unity Point Hospice. The former Marilyn Retta Thomas was born March 1st, 1923, to Clifford and Loretta Walker Thomas in Highland Park, Michigan. She married the love of her life, Donald Hagman, on January 17th, 1946, at the Naval Base in California. In 1977, they retired to Port Charlotte, Florida, and enjoyed living there for nearly 23 years. On August 31st of 2003, after 56 years of marriage, Donald passed away. Marilyn enjoyed researching her family's genealogy, hand-quilting many beautiful quilts, playing dominoes with her special domino ladies, and loved reading, was always reading two or three books a week. She was also an excellent seamstress, but above all else, she enjoyed spending time with her family and loved them all dearly. She is survived by her daughters, Nancy and Tricia, and her grandchildren, her great-grandchildren, and she was preceded in death by her husband, her parents, and her sisters. From Rock Island, Annie L. Pulliam. Annie L. Pulliam, 78, of Rock Island, passed away Monday, May 6th at her home. A memorial service will be at 10 a.m. Saturday, May 11th at the Whelan Presley Funeral Home and Crematory in Rock Island. Memorials may be made to the family. Survivors include her husband, James, her son, James, Terry, and Jerry. She was preceded in death by her parents and a sibling, a son, and a grandchild. To share condolences with the family and to see the full obituary, please visit www.whelanpresley.com. And we have four pending obituaries. Dorothy C. Kettleson, age 91, of DeWitt, passed away Tuesday, May 7th at Fieldstone of DeWitt. Arrangements are in care of the Schultz Funeral Home in DeWitt. Junior D. McAdams, 101, of Wheatland, Iowa, formerly of Rock Island, Illinois, passed away Sunday, May 5th at Wheatland Manor in Wheatland. Arrangements are pending at Whelan Presley Funeral Home and Crematory in Rock Island. Michael Jaquan Robinson, age 22, of Davenport, passed away Saturday, May 4th in East Moline. Cremation will be directed by Mississippi Valley Cremation and direct burial in Moline. And finally, Robert Rummerfield, age 56, of East Moline, Illinois, passed away Wednesday, May 8th at Allura of Moline. Cremation will be directed by Mississippi Valley Cremation and direct burial of Moline.
Okay, and now we're going to turn to the opinion section. And there is another view column out of the Tampa Bay Times. Retirement is becoming luxury in U.S. Americans living longer, just as Medicare and Social Security are running short. Older adults add incredible value to America's workforce, but increasingly seniors are returning to work to merely make ends meet. Low savings, longer lives, and a rickety safety net are combining to present new challenges, especially in Florida. It's a reminder that society benefits both from ready employment and from protecting Americans' golden years. A survey released last month by AARP puts the sobering facts into perspective. One in five adults over age 50 say they have no retirement savings, and nearly two-thirds are worried they will not have enough money to support themselves in retirement. Nearly one-third of older adults who roll over credit card debt report carrying a balance of $10,000 or more, while more seniors are racking up heavier debt from a year ago. While about one-third expect their finances to improve over the coming 12 months, a larger percentage is worried about prices outpacing their incomes and their ability to cover basic expenses. The gloomy outlook raises red flags both for America's seniors and states like Florida that have long sold themselves as retirement havens. The figure of one in five adults over age 50 with no retirement savings came from interviews completed with more than 8,000 people, the AARP said. One-fourth also expect to never retire, a share that has steadily increased in the twice-yearly survey since 2022. Seniors bring a wealth of value to the workplace, from life experience and varied skill sets to a reputation for being dependable. By 2030, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, nearly 12% of people ages 75 and older will be working, more than double the rate in 2000. They are a key age group whose participation in the workforce fills a critical need in the economy. Beyond earning a paycheck, many seniors also credit working with staying mentally sharp and socially engaged. But it's one thing for Americans to work as long as they're able and interested. It's another when seniors are re-entering the workforce because their finances and the social safety net forces them there. According to the latest annual reports, Medicare, the government-sponsored health insurance that covers 65 million older and disabled Americans, will run short of paying full benefits by 2031, while Social Security will run short of full benefits to 66 million retirees only 2 years later. Government and business need to work across a range of fronts to protect pensions, bolster Medicare and Social Security, and promote retirement savings plans to younger workers. Americans are 15 times more likely to save for retirement when they have access to a workplace plan. Older Americans should be in the workforce by choice. That requires Americans to save more throughout their working lives and for the government to adequately protect the nation's safety net for all retirees.
The 10 Civic Commitments for a Stronger United States. This is written by Kevin Frazier. He is an assistant professor at the Crump College of Law at St. Thomas University in Miami Gardens, Florida. Starting this summer, he will serve as a Tarbell Fellow. He wrote this for The Fulcrum, which covers what's making democracy dysfunctional and efforts to fix our governing systems. A healthy democracy requires civic morality. Absent a set of virtues, principles, and norms, our constitutional order falls apart like an IKEA bed that's missing screws. We must develop and adhere to a new civic code. This code should minimally install within every American 10 commitments. Number one, participate. Being a good citizen goes above and beyond voting. We can and should aspire to participate in a broader sense, taking advantage of opportunities to shape democratic action at the local, state, and federal levels. Number two, learn. The more you learn about your community and your neighbors, the more impactful your participation will be. Three, give. The greater your stake in the community, the more inclined you'll be to participate and learn. If you have time, volunteer. If you have money, donate. If you have both, do both. If you have neither, you can still give your undivided attention, trading time scrolling Instagram for time seeking out local news. Number four, join. The United States has long enjoyed a reputation as a nation of joiners. Increasingly, it seems we'd be better characterized as a nation of loners. That's a problem. As mentioned above, the more ties you have to your community, the easier it will be to satisfy the prior commitments. So find a group, a club, or other gathering that's made up of folks in your local community. Number five, trust. Our public, private, and nonprofit institutions are losing their ability to effectively solve problems due to a lack of trust among the public writ large. In some cases, such skepticism is merited. That said, a democracy defined by distrust has an expiration date. A commitment to trust means avoiding speculative and specious thinking. Number six, wait. The Constitution outlines intentionally inefficient processes. Deliberation takes time. Of course, such patience isn't justified if people or parties are intentionally delaying democratic processes. Number seven, respect. Respect the democratic process and its participants will go a long way toward a healthier civic sphere. Notably, this attitude will be much easier as these commitments become more widespread. Number eight, advocate. You do not need to be the next Rachel Carson, the environmental activist who wrote Silent Spring, or Ralph Nader, who pressed for life-saving consumer protections to satisfy this requirement, but you do need to step up when you have 2 cents to offer on a relevant issue. Those 2 cents, when combined with the contributions of others and integrated into the proper democratic process, will be worth a nickel, even with inflation. Number 9, represent. You may know folks or causes that do not have the time, resources, or attention to engage as fully in the democratic process as they would like. You can and should try to represent their interests. This will lead to a more robust and representative discourse. And finally, number 10, celebrate. It's really, really easy to knock our democracy for all of its faults. We've got to get into the practice of celebrating when it works. You can't at once think there's a lot of room for improvement and acknowledge that the system occasionally does work as intended. Our nation's founders anticipated and encouraged the population to share some basic values. Though they ended the practice of state-supported religions, they very much encouraged the people to adopt and adhere to a faith. Their idea was good congregants would be good community members. In brief, if you respect your God, then you'll respect the government. And if you have ties to your faith community, then you'll have a stake in your civic community. Nowadays, we need not all rush to the nearest mosque, synagogue, or church to be good citizens. We've come to accept that people may source their morals from a diverse set of options. Nevertheless, we do need to admit that a democracy without civic virtue is destined to come apart at the seams. Adherence to the 10 civic commitments identified above will serve as glue, binding us to one another as well as to our democratic processes.
And our final column in the opinion section is by Jonah Goldberg, who is editor-in-chief of the Dispatch. What happened to the Republican war on woke? This isn't going to be more musings about whether America has reached peak woke, but that is part of the story, so let's start there. About a decade ago, many on the left embraced the word woke, a term with roots in African-American culture and activism. It originally meant staying awake, that is, woke, to the dangers facing the black community. But in the hands of the broader and whiter academic and journalistic left, it soon became a kind of cool catch-all for progressive politics. The combined effects of the Trump presidency, the death of George Floyd, and the COVID-19 pandemic pushed wokeness into overdrive. This was the era of defund the police and other radical inanities. The right soon took up the word, using woke as a catch-all for everything it hated about the left. The novelty of wokeness as a concept lent an equal edginess to anti-wokeness. The same thing happened with political correctness in the early 90s. Republican politicians declared war on wokeness. Erstwhile presidential candidate and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis was at the anti-woke vanguard, even pushing the Stop Woke Act through the state legislature. It didn't work out too well for DeSantis or his imitators. But that's the point. Both wokeness and anti-wokeness have lost their transgressive edge. Now they're both kind of cringe, as the kids say. And that is a sign of healing. One of the worst annoyances of polarized politics is the way the fringes symbiotically feed off each other, like bootleggers and Baptists, both benefiting from blue laws. The extreme left and extreme right need each other to justify their catastrophizing. The worst thing that could happen for Republican House fundraising efforts would be for the squad of far-left members of Congress to be replaced by sensible Democrats. And the last thing the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee wants is for Marjorie Taylor Greene to be primaried by an intelligent Republican who doesn't talk about Jewish space lasers. So is woke over? Probably not. The term might be in terminal decline as anything other than an epithet, but the ideas are going to be around for a while, as will anti-wokeness, because both are just stand-ins for the culture wars left and right. But many on the left are starting to realize they went too far. Most Democrats don't talk about defunding the police anymore because it is a wildly unpopular idea, including among black people. The Massachusetts Institute of Technology will no longer require applicants for faculty jobs to submit diversity statements confirming their support for diversity, inclusion, and belonging. A slew of elite schools have reversed course by requiring standardized tests again. Big corporations are paring back their diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI departments, which surged under Trump. and the explosion of lawlessness and anti-Semitic rhetoric on elite campuses has been a lesson for academia, the left, and Democrats. The country isn't that into disorder and bigotry. There's a lesson here for the right, too. For a decade, the populist right has been whining about losing every battle in the culture war to rationalize its embrace of radical and authoritarian politics. But the right doesn't always lose or win any more than the left does. Trump and his supporters insist that America can't survive without him in the White House. William Barr, who was Attorney General under Trump, says his former boss is utterly unfit to be president, but that he will still vote for him because a second Biden term would amount to national suicide because of wokeness or something. Never mind that wokeness surged under Trump and has been receding under Biden. Obviously, the right and left still have plenty to complain and worry about. The point is that there's always plenty to complain and worry about. Tides come and go, and people learn eventually from their mistakes.
And now we'll take a look at sports. In boys soccer, from Bettendorf, title within reach. Bettendorf needs one more win. Also, it will host Substate. This is written by Dave Selvig. Bettendorf's latest stellar boys soccer season has been a total team effort. One win away from a second straight Mississippi Athletic Conference title, the Bulldogs don't rely on one or two people to carry the load. A deep side allows for strong practices, competition for time on the pitch, and a lot of wins, 13 and 16 games this season. Head coach Ben Pennington, who has seen every Bettendorf team since starting the program in 1982, said, "The balance we have, we're not depending on one or two outstanding players. It's probably been the biggest thing for us this season. The kids have been very accepting of their roles. The team gets along really well. It's an easy group to be around. I love coming to practice every day." The Bulldogs are coming off a 1-0 road win over North Scott on Tuesday, putting them within one win of a conference title. Beating upstart Davenport North, whose season is 9-4, 6-1 in their conference on Thursday at Tuvel Stadium, would seal the deal on an outright MAC crown. The Bulldogs' strong season has already secured a coveted Substate host chance, meaning a trip to Des Moines goes through Bettendorf. The Substate final, potentially against fellow MAC power Pleasant Valley, will be played May 22nd at Tuvel Stadium. Pennington said of hosting Substate, "We don't have to leave home again, and that's an advantage. But, of course, it doesn't guarantee anything. Our focus is on Davenport North. They've had a very good season. Winning back-to-back MAC championships is something our players could tell their kids." The Bulldogs have allowed just 12 goals this season, getting standout play from sophomore goalkeeper Peyton Douglas, whom Pennington considers one of the best goalies in Iowa. In front of Douglas, a strong back line features senior captain Caden Vanderweel, who is headed to Wisconsin Stevens Point to play soccer in the fall. Senior James Porter and sophomores Cam Scruppum and Landon Baffa. Tyler Augusta, one of a talented crop of 10th graders, plays a holding midfield position, allowing the Bulldogs to send a wave of skilled players forward. Bettendorf's 60 goals have been spread out among 13 players. Five players have scored five goals or more, led by junior forward Landon Potts, who leads the Bulldogs in goals at 15 and has 11 assists. Potts scored the lone goal in Tuesday's 1-0 win over North Scott, although the Bulldogs did miss two PKs. Senior Chase Wakefield, a Division I commit to Drake, has 12 goals in 11 games after missing five games because of an injury. Junior Isaiah Gutten has 12 goals. Potts, Wakefield, and Gutten trail only Davenport Central junior Joseph Minter at 21 goals and Central DeWitt freshman Johnson Garrison at 18 goals in their conference, the MAC. Sophomore Isaac Mieha also started 15 games and has 5 goals. Charlie Zimmerman, part of the Bulldogs' deep bench, has 5 goals and 9 appearances. Zimmerman, Bettendorf's quarterback during the football season, is headed to Division III power Wartburg to play football in the fall. Senior Captain Cooper Augusta is headed to the Naval Academy. Seniors Elias Lightfoot, 5 starts, and Luke Christensen, juniors Caleb Rankin, who also runs track, and Will Neighbor, with 6 starts, gave Pennington plenty of options off the bench. Coach Pennington said, "I have a lot of faith in all of our kids. They're good players. Depending on if it's a hot game competitively or a hot game weather-wise, it kind of varies from game to game, but we are fortunate to have the number of kids we do. And there's still some things to work on, though. We haven't been very strong on corner kicks and crossing the ball," Pennington said. "Midfield needs to lighten up a little. There are huge gaps between our defense and forward sometimes. But wins over 12-2 Pleasant Valley and perennial state title contender Dowling Catholic with a season 14-2 prove the Bulldogs' A game puts them squarely in the mix, even if it's a team that does not have quite the same personality as its longtime coach." Pennington said they're very close in their personalities, and that's certainly not a knock. It's a very pleasant group to be around. "My style is very strict and disciplined. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't, but they play the right way and care about each other, and those things are also very important."
And we have college softball from the University of Iowa. Moss earns all Big Ten honors. Junior who played at Muscatine had .390 average. Former Muscatine High School athlete Riley Moss has been named second team All Big Ten in softball. Moss, the top hitter all season for Iowa, led the Hawkeyes with a .390 batting average in 39 games before suffering a season-ending injury against Nebraska on April 23rd. Before the injury, Moss started every game in right field for the Hawkeyes. She recorded a hit in all but 7 games in which she played, and at one point had a career-high 14 game-on-base streak. Moss, a junior, recorded 3 hit games against CSU, Bakersfield, and Michigan. To go along with her .390 batting average, Ross also scored 21 runs, had 8 RBIs, and was 5-for-5 on stolen bases. Of her 48 hits, 46 were singles. The other 2 were doubles. The Hawkeyes finished the season with a record of 18-28. The former All-State player for the Muskies blossomed this season after seeing action in 64 games over her first 2 seasons as a Hawkeye. As a freshman in 2022, she had 2 hits in 19 at-bats for a .105 average, and she had no at-bats in 28 games as a sophomore, although she scored 11 runs. And I'm going to give you a rundown quickly of the on-the-air sports today. At 7 p.m. this evening in college baseball, we have Georgia at South Carolina on ESPNU. In college softball, at noon today, Pac-12 quarterfinal, Utah versus Oregon on the Pac-12 network. 12:30, ACC quarterfinal, Clemson versus Virginia on the ACCN network. At 1 o'clock, SEC quarterfinal to be decided versus Arkansas on SECN. At 1:30, Big Ten quarterfinal to be decided against Nebraska on BTN. At 2:30, Pac-12 quarterfinal, California versus Stanford on the Pac-12 network. At 4 o'clock, ACC quarterfinal, someone will be playing Florida State on the ACCN network. And at 4 o'clock in the SEC quarterfinal, someone will be playing Florida on SECN. At 4:30, Big Ten quarterfinal, someone will be playing Michigan on BTN. And at 6 o'clock is the Pac-12 quarterfinal, someone playing UCLA on the Pac-12 network. At 6:30, ACC quarterfinal, Georgia Tech versus Virginia Tech on ACCN. At 7, the Big Ten quarterfinal to be decided versus Rutgers on BTN. And at the SEC quarterfinal to be decided versus Texas A&M on SECN. At 8:30, Pac-12 quarterfinal, Arizona versus Washington on the Pac-12 network. In golf at 1 o'clock today on the PGA Tour is the Wells Fargo Championship on the Golf Channel. At 12 o'clock in horse racing, the NYRA, America's Day at the Races on FS2. In Major League Baseball at noon, Seattle is at Minnesota on the Major League Baseball Network. On that same network at 4 o'clock, we have Houston at New York Yankees, and at 6:40, St. Louis at Milwaukee. Also at 6:40 on NBCS Chicago, we have Cleveland at Chicago White Sox. At 8:30 on FS1, we have Kansas City at the LA Angels. In the NBA playoffs, at 6 o'clock in Game 2, we have Cleveland at Boston on ESPN. And then later on ESPN at 8:30, we have Game 2, Dallas at Oklahoma City. In the NHL playoffs, on TNT at 6 o'clock, we have Game 3. The New York Rangers are at Carolina. And on TNT also at 8:30, we have Game 2, Colorado at Dallas. In soccer at 1:55, the Europa League semis, AS Roma at Bayer Lever on CBSSN. And finally, in the WNBA preseason at 6 o'clock, Atlanta is at Indiana. And that's on the WNBA League Pass. And that brings us to the end of the Quad City Times for today. I'm Teresa Whitaker, and my partner at the microphone has been Lisa Horsch. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.